listener-supported KTOO. Welcome to Juno Afternoon's Rainy Day Conversations, broadcasting from the homelands of the Occoquan and on demand as a podcast. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. Gunathchish, Hawa, Toexik Nusam, Salama. Thank you for sharing your time with us. Today, our guest is Vera Starbart. Vera is Tlingit and Dena'ina Athabaskan and was born in Craig, Alaska. She's the current writer laureate for the state of Alaska. Vera is a three-time Emmy-nominated writer, editor, and playwright. You may have seen her plays at Perseverance Theater here in Juneau, or seen episodes of her work on the ABC show Alaska Daily and the PBS animated series Molly of Denali. She also served as editor of First Alaskans magazine for over 10 years. Grab a warm beverage and a nice cozy chair. It's our Rainy Day Conversation with Vera Starbart, coming up this hour on Juno Afternoon.
Hanson Gress, ka eat with the shu yi, we kashuk a yi tin. Jin kat ka ke jin ta khanakhaya ha anikak, gunish cheesh.
Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, providing Juno with locally roasted coffee for over 40 years, with cafes and drive-through locations throughout Juno. More at heritagecoffee.com. KTOO would like to acknowledge that we broadcast from the homelands of the Occoquan. The Clan Edie have stewarded this area for thousands of years. Today, our studios sit on a spot once part of the tidelands, now covered over with buildings, roads, and parking lots. We recognize those families who traveled to and from these tidelands to fishing and hunting grounds and to gatherings in other villages and still cherish it as an important part of their way of life for today and for future generations. You are listening to community-supported Juno Afternoon on KTOO at 104.3 Juno, 91.7 Juno Auk Bay, and online at ktoo.org. I'm Boston Christopher. It's a pleasure to welcome to Studio 2K, named in honor of Carolyn Hobbs Peterson, the Emmy-nominated writer laureate for the state of Alaska, Vera Starbart. In October of 2024, Vera was named Alaska's state writer laureate. It's a two-year appointment recognizing an Alaskan writer who has demonstrated literary excellence and a commitment to the advancement of literary arts in Alaska communities. Vera's writing career spans genres from journalism, novels, plays, and most recently screenplays for the likes of ABC's Alaska Daily and PBS's Molly of Denali. She will serve through 2026 as the writer laureate, promoting literary arts and artists in Alaska. She has a passion for uplifting Alaska Native storytelling and is, in her words, a book nerd at heart. And with many projects in various stages of development, we're sure to have much from Vera to look forward to in those coming years. Gunathchish, ha igudi, thank you so much, Vera. It's a pleasure to have you joining us for our rainy day conversation. Was iati, how's it going?
Pretty good. Gunathchish, and thanks for having me.
Awesome. Would you introduce yourself and tell us about where you were born?
I'm Vera Starbart, Setkwayhut Duasak, Trinity Hutsati. I'm Tlingit and Dena'ina. I was born in Craig on Prince of Wales Island, but as my dad was a state trooper, we moved pretty much every year. So I grew up literally all over Alaska. So Alaska is my home.
And now you make your way in Juneau.
Yes, we moved to Juneau, specifically Douglas Island, a little over 2 years ago, and we hope to make this our forever home. So hopefully this is it. This is the last move.
We hope it's your forever home, too. So congratulations on being named the Alaska Writer Laureate. Will you share how you found out you would be receiving this distinction?
I did know that Vivian Faith Prescott asked for, you know, my info and my resume and stuff. I thought that was a very long shot. I genuinely thought I was too young. Surprise, I'm not. I'm old enough now. Honestly, I didn't think I had done enough for the honor. So when Ben Brown actually called me, I was speechless for a second. It's a huge honor. Some people I admire very, very, very much have had that honor before, and I thought I was quite a long ways away from receiving that honor. So it was a great day. I then cried, and then I called my husband, and then we went out to dinner.
let's talk about your plans as the Alaska Writer Laureate. Are there official duties?
The official duties are purposely very vague. It's just in support of literacy in Alaska or literary arts, which could be so many things. And they don't require anything specific of you other than just accepting it and then committing to projects. I still haven't chosen those projects. I have several, too many, for 2 years to do. It does come with a little bit of funding, although some of the idea of it is they hope that other organizations or communities will invite you and cover your travel and stuff to go to that community and speak on whatever or hold a workshop or whatever it is they really might see as valuable for a Writer Laureate to do. So a lot of it is to be determined by communities who might want me to go there, or organizations, and some of it is going to be whatever I decide to do as sort of a big public project.
What is your hope for writing in Alaska over the coming years?
I hope to see voices that we've never heard from before. I have a handful of people that in my mind would make the most amazing quote-unquote professional writers as far as getting professionally published who have not been. I want to see people like that who have more confidence or just take the risk, take the chance to put their stuff out there because they have wonderful, beautiful, amazing stories to tell. And that is sort of always on my heart as far as what do I want to see next, period. For specifically Alaska, I wish people knew when I'm in these rooms, whether it's a network TV room or a publishing house room or other journalism. I've done journalism my whole career too. They want to know about Alaskans. Like, we're pretty weird, right? we have pretty unique lives, even in the cities, when it's compared to anywhere else in the world, not even just the country. And they're fascinated by it. Like, your daily, everyday life is so unique to the world. I know it sounds a little bit cliche, but it truly is. If you're from Alaska, you can pretty confidently say that. And people are so interested in it. And we have lessons and values and beliefs up here that just aren't a part of anyone else's being. And they get so surprised by it. I've been surprised at how surprised they are when I mention something that I think is so normal and is really unusual to them and they want to know more about it. So I want to hear from all those people who constantly tell me, like, well, I'm not a writer, but you're a writer. If you can write, you're a writer. And usually what I try and tell them, like, as a magazine editor or if they just want me to look at their stuff, look, just write whatever, write what you know. An editor will change that later. That's my job as an editor. I can adjust it. And inevitably what happens 99% of the time is it doesn't actually need that much change. They just needed to write it. So that was a very long-winded answer to, I just want to see all those people who haven't been writing and telling their stories, writing. And you don't have to write. That's maybe a little weird for me to say as a writer. I want to see the stories regardless. So maybe that's in some other artistic or creative form. But obviously, I'm here to help with the writing.
As the Writer Laureate, you have the opportunity to work on a special project for yourself. Is there anything that you have come to a decision on, or are you still playing around with the different ones you might do?
Definitely still playing around with the different ones, because part of what I want to decide on is what can I do that is unique to this that maybe would be hard for me to do otherwise, that I need these kind of resources or this kind of attention to do. With the laureate position, there is sort of an automatic spotlight on what you do. What could I bring attention to, or what are people already doing that I can help with? I have thought of things like, spoiler alert, that, for instance, putting together like an Alaska Native fiction anthology of inviting other writers to both mentor and be mentees on a project that then we're publishing their writing. Is that an appropriate one? And if that doesn't come about this one, honestly, that's something I just want to do regardless, but that's something I'm thinking about. I'm thinking about a pretty intensive online kind of thing because it's much of the state is so physically inaccessible from community to community. So can there be something that I could set up in this 2 years that lives longer than that? Once I'm out of this position, can there be a community online that also meet in person, but primarily online, that lives longer than this position can be? So those are two of the kind of main vague things I'm thinking about right now. And obviously, like, I think I've been doing workshops. I've done workshops for years, maybe just boosting that kind of. There's more than 2 years worth of ideas. It's picking the best ones for both the time and resources that we have.
Let's take a break. Our guest is Vera Starbard, Emmy-nominated writer and Alaska's Writer Laureate through 2026. This is Juno Afternoon's Rainy Day Conversations from KTOO. This is Juno Afternoon, Rainy Day Conversations. I'm with my guest, Vera Starbard, a three-time Emmy-nominated writer and the current Alaska State Writer Laureate. I want to go back to the beginning, Vera. When did writing enter your consciousness? Like, at what age did the written word start to appear to you as a thing?
So early. I was actually, it's funny that my first act of literature, I guess, is sort of family lore at this point, because my older sister, Carla, she's 16 months older than me, and she was 5 years old, and they were teaching her to read. She's in kindergarten, whatever. And I had just turned 4. I want to read too. I wanted to do whatever my sister did. I really did. And so she was reading. I wanted to read. And as legend goes, they wouldn't, or at least they were trying to put me off because I was being pretty annoying about it. So I decided to teach myself to read at 4. And I came in with a stack of books and said I could read. And they're like, sure, right? And I opened books and just started reading very defiantly. So they gave me a book that maybe I memorized it. They hand me a different book and I could read it. And these are simple books, but still, like, just taught myself to read. Like, that's it. So my entry into it was fairly defiant and built out of wanting to be like my sister and spiteful. But since then, it's grown into a pretty deep love, including by 5 years old. In kindergarten, I was already telling my parents I wanted to be a poet. I always, always loved it, like truly. And I think if you run into people from my high school and I tell them what I do now, and they're like, yeah, that's what I thought.
That tracks.
I've never had any other plan. The other plan I had for my life is, what am I going to do to support myself until you are eventually a professional writer? And it's in some ways it's almost boring, because it's just, I said I wanted to do it my entire life, and that's what I'm doing.
How did you teach yourself to read?
Good question. I don't know. And I actually went to school to see if my first year of college to see if I wanted to become a teacher, because I had such respect for that. I found out around that time I didn't know how to teach people to read, because I didn't know how I had done it. Mm. when the sounding out is, like, I don't know, it just is. That's the word. I do clearly remember sitting there with a box of it wasn't Hooked on Phonics, but I don't know if you remember. This is dating me, but this is aging me very much. But kind of like Hooked on Phonics, were these placards, these cards with words on it. And I was so fascinated. I'd love to play with these cards that had just words on them. And I clearly remember that. And I had to be 2 or 3 years old when they got those sets and I was playing with it. So I just absorbed, I guess, through osmosis.
Seems like it was just sort of meant to be, you and the written word.
Yeah, I think, I have to give a lot of credit to both my parents for reading to us. I mean, also a bit of a cliche, but so important, reading to us every single night. My grandparents had stacks of books that, you know, we'd bring out. And I remember my little sister doing the same thing, just a stack of books at 3 years old. And who wants to read with me? And they would. So my parents, I have to give credit there. I have to imagine there was an awful lot of absorbing when they were reading or telling stories orally. Which also helpful for the creative writing gene. But yeah, it just, that's, I never imagined doing anything else, and I can't believe I'm able to do it, you know?
What is it about that written word that captures your imagination?
I think it was definitely finding out about these other worlds that in Craig, Alaska, or Kodiak, or Juneau, or Anchorage, where, when I was growing up, these worlds that were light years, sometimes literally, because I like sci-fi, light years away from what I knew, and just being able to imagine and being completely absorbed in that. I definitely had a reputation as a kid for getting totally lost in a book, just, you know, having to snap their fingers to get me back to attention kind of a thing. And I don't know, that part of it, the imagination part of it, and losing yourself into, whether it's a modern day girl or set of girls. I loved Babysitter's Club when I was younger. That was one of my first chapter books that I just got so obsessed with. These are girls that were my own age who had a club and had a business and did all these fun things. Or I also always loved fantasy and sci-fi, literally going into different planets and dragons and all of these things. It's something that you can escape in. And I think for most of my life, I should say childhood, it was an escape. I did have, starting very young, and this is fairly public knowledge for me, so it's not necessarily anything new. My first play was about the discovery of my own sexual abuse. That was an escape from the trauma that I had from that, that for the first part of my life without my parents knowing, and then after they found out and were, you know, addressing it, the escape from that, like the finding out can be as traumatizing, you know, as the actual abuse itself. And that was pretty rough through most of my childhood. So it was just a great place to escape. There's sometimes a danger in it, I know now as an adult, to completely escaping. But in some ways, books saved my life. Books were what rescued me from sort of some of the horrors of that abuse.
Okay, we'll take a break and we'll come back and talk with more with Vera Starbart, Emmy-nominated writer and Alaska's Writer Laureate through 2026. This is Juno Afternoon's Rainy Day Conversations from KTOO. Welcome back to Juno Afternoon, a rainy day conversation with Vera Starbart, my guest, a three-time Emmy-nominated writer and the Alaska State Writer Laureate. What inspires you in writing? Like, who inspires you in writing, or what inspires you about writing?
Oh, gosh. Reading other people's words inevitably inspires me to write. Sometimes that's with the bad writing and I just just make something better. Usually it's fascinating to me how people can just weave together. I actually just learned pretty recently text, sort of the word text, if some people that's how you say a book, comes from the textiles, the weaving tradition. And that is absolutely how I've seen writing for an awful long time. And it's fascinating to be able to see how people weave all these words together. Same words we all use, mostly, you know, not new words to us, and make something completely different than anyone else in the whole world can do. So if I'm in a bit of a writing slump, which usually means I'm boring myself with my own writing. Like, it's almost always what I know. Like, I never stop writing. I write every single day. But if I'm really bored with myself, I'll go find a book that I think I might be inspired by. And usually that works. Like, it's fascinating to me to see what other people do with those same 26 letters.
And who inspires you in your life? Like, who are the people in your life that inspire you?
All my family. My first play was about my family, really. It was about my mom. And like anybody, she's with flaws, but I just really wanted to show the world. Like, the intent of a lot of that play was just to show the world where she had come from and how incredible it was that she accomplished what she did in protecting me through that. My next play was, while it was this story that was taken as inspired from Tlingit tradition and stories, and I've always been inspired by that, ultimately it was a family drama again.
Right.
And I literally borrowed the Tlingit names from my family to attach to the characters. Some of them matched, some of them didn't as far as the personalities, but because I so strongly saw different parts of that and from my family, the Native Pride and Prejudice play that I have, it's very much a family drama. People, it's not always specifically family, but people. I name a lot of characters after people I know because that's where I draw from. I try not to talk about it too much so it doesn't freak people out that I know. whether it's just one little personality thing or something they said that inspires me, I have always loved sort of the study of psychology and sociology. I say study very lightly. Like, my study is more of Googling things until the ends of the earth. I can stay in the research phase of a project for way too long. I usually have to limit myself and go, at a certain point, what you have is what you have, because I'll just keep researching. I love that. So just people and the quirks they have and the contradictions they have has always fascinated me, and why they do what they do. So it starts with the family. Fortunately, unfortunately for my family. And the funny thing is, my parents and my brothers and sisters are always heavily involved with most of my larger projects. Like, it's kind of a running joke now with people I work with, where you get one, you get them all. Like, you get one Starboard, you're going to get all of them. And they've literally traveled to New York or LA just to see a play reading, or, you know, to see an announcement. So I have the most supportive family in the world.
When did you begin to think about writing as a profession?
Ooh. Definitely, even at 5 when I was saying a poet, I knew some vague sense of it's a job. Thank goodness my parents, when I told them I wanted to be a poet at 5, you know, didn't go, okay, no one really supports themselves as a poet. They just gave me some, you know, journals and let me have at it. I think realistically, in high school, I was reading writer's resource books. There's something called the writer's market book. It's a huge just list of agents and publishing houses. I had bought several copies of that. They renew it every year in high school, which is a very nerdy thing to do. And that's when I think I really started going, this is what I want to do for my life, so I need to set myself up for success. And to be honest, I think more than any talent I may or may not have, more than any sort of writing skill, I genuinely think that early realistic look at the business and understanding that is what led to my quote-unquote success as a writer later. It's really tough to be a professional writer. Like, no one hires you out of the gate as a creative writer. Like, that's just not a thing. So you have to write an awful lot for free, you know, with no hope of publication before people start to actually hire you as a creative writer, whether that's in TV or for a book or whatever. So I think, yeah, I mean, it truly was in high school when I was even looking at colleges to go to. It was not simply a what college do I go to figure out a career? It's what college do I go to that can help me support myself while I try and build this career?
I know out of high school, you started editing and you started working pretty soon after high school as an editor for professional publications, right?
Yeah, it was literally one of my first jobs out of high school was first as a copy editor for a biweekly newspaper, which was the last person to see the paper at 4 a.m. or whatever it was, which is a great time to edit, by the way, when you're trying to catch little details. Last person to see it going out. And that hit with some early success as far as I also, you know, tried to do some pieces in writing when I could or when they'd let me let this 18-year-old kid, you know, coming at the time, I thought I was pretty mature. But now I look at 18-year-olds and just go, oh, the fact that they trusted me at all to try that. And I had done, I'd been, and this is why nobody in high school is surprised at what I'm doing. I was editor of the newspaper in high school. So I had experience with the world and transitioning that to actually being paid for it was pretty thrilling. I then became assistant news editor fairly quickly because I think they could just see that I took it pretty seriously. Again, 18 years old. I don't know what they're thinking, really, but I loved it.
Ambition.
Yeah, it really was. It was also while I had gone to that school to decide that this was in Reno to decide between being going into education or journalism. And that was pretty central to that decision, too, of going, oh, boy, I love teaching and I just don't have the patience for it. Like, God bless teachers.
Yeah, right.
To do that and to struggle with, you know, kids. Like, to me, the most important part of teaching is taking those struggling kids and helping them. And I didn't necessarily know how to do that or have the patience for it. But journalism and writing and that background kind of popped out at me during that time. One of my very first jobs. I had two or three jobs during that first year of college. Like I was working. I did not sleep.
I know you've also done a lot of work as a public relations person for a variety of different organizations. Is there something for you that connects narrative writing and professional business writing? What is the connection for you there?
Storytelling. It's telling a story. And I think the public relations and communications and marketing people I admire the most, and I do another nerdy thing. I follow a lot of them on different like newsletters and TikTok and stuff. They know it's about storytelling and they know, you know, this is about a narrative and people, I think public relations people often get a pretty bad rap because the ones you hear about are sort of like the ones trying to cover up for celebrities or politicians or whatever, but most are for mine, which was entirely in nonprofits, was about letting the public know your story and how you're engaging with them and you, what is that relationship with the community. And I loved that part of it. And whether it was, again, editing the sort of newsletter for an organization or writing press releases, it's all about here's an authentic story. And that's, again, where I think the best PR people are. This is authenticity, and this is what we want you to know about us. So it definitely honed a lot of my writing skills as far as just the structure of a story. And so much of it is about relating to the audience, whether it's Night at the Opera or, you know, this is why we think this product would be helpful to you or, you know, why we think our organization is worth looking at and having that empathy toward them. I mean, that's truly what it takes an awful lot of empathy or at least understanding of psychology to be really good at that. And to be clear, that doesn't mean I was really good at it. Like I was definitely not supporting. I liked editing in the newspapers. I liked being in the background support and actually formulating the communication strategies. I loved that. The people up front were purposely not me usually.
When did playwriting enter your life?
Interestingly enough, at that time that I was in public relations and kind of wondering if public relations was going to be my career while I sort of did as much creative writing as I could at the time. A lot of people don't know that even New York Times best-selling authors have to support themselves with another career. We don't have time to break down exactly how much an author does not make, but it's not much for the sheer amount of work. Like the few that you hear of, the Stephen Kings and the J.K. Rowlings and stuff that can are one in a million or billion, really. Most authors have to support themselves with something else to do. So during that time, I really was wondering if this sort of PR and communications was going to be what I did while also writing books. And that was I was just going to write books, you know, right? Like that was what I knew. That was honestly like what I knew other Native writers had done. I had not seen Native playwrights. I had not seen Native TV writers before. Like I didn't know of any. So to me, that was the only example I had of like what you could become as a writer. And honestly, I had never written a script. So that just wasn't on my mind. So I saw this. I just finished my first novel, just finished writing it, and didn't love the dialogue that I had. And I saw like a Facebook thing pop up for the Alaska Native Playwright Project. It's basically like you apply, there's a 1-year commitment, and they'll teach you how to write a play during that time. So established authors or writers, but will teach playwriting to people who'd never done playwriting before. And that was my entire hope with it, was that I would do this year, I would write a play that would never see the light of day. And after it, my dialogue for my book would be better. So that was my entire goal with playwriting. I didn't know anything about playwriting. And it's so funny because in the first, there was a 10-day intensive to start that. And the person who would become my mentor, Larissa Fasthorse, she was not my mentor at the time, but she was there teaching a wonderful award-winning literal MacArthur genius. And she said, playwriting and plays is a highly collaborative process. You have to collaborate with people to be able to do this. If you just want to write by yourself, go write a book. And in my head, I had been like, yeah, that's what I did. Like, you know? And so I really was at the time like, okay, these people don't know. And I feel a little shady being in here and not really taking playwriting seriously. But after that year, that process of going through that year with her then assigned as my mentor, I wrote this really tough book. I don't know why I chose to spend an entire year writing about my own sexual abuse as a child, but that was an interesting year. The end of it, there was a public reading where a director and actors took that script, and it was like one, maybe two little rehearsals, and then they read from the script. So it wasn't a whole stage thing, but seeing what they then did with my script, that's what got me hooked. Was, oh my goodness, they made this so much better than what I wrote. They took it, they made it alive. I don't know how they took it, you know, in some like what they imagined was even better than what I imagined in my head. That's what eventually got me hooked. And then sort of the rest is history, you know, however many plays later, and being a playwright in residence at Perseverance. So it was very accidental entry in, and here we are now.
That's where that collaborative process that Larissa was talking about comes from. You're talking about Our Voices Will Be Heard. This was the play that premiered at Perseverance Theater. It was your first professional play. And like you said, it was a deeply personal one. Probably because, you know, I wonder if in that workshop, they were like, write what you know.
Yeah.
Write what you know. That's what you hear a lot in those workshops. And so you're like, well, what do I know? What do I know about my life? And you're like, there it is, right?
Yeah.
And do I want to confront that? And do I want to work that through? How did the experience of writing that play unfold for you?
It was really tough personally. That was a tough year just in general. But one of the main characters of the play was my uncle, and my uncle was the one who abused me. He just, not even 2 months after I sort of put forth, basically the play itself was based on a short story that was very allegorical that I had written in high school. And it was about my abuse in sort of very allegorical terms. About 2 months after this, while I'm in the middle of starting writing that play, I'd done the first 10 pages, that same uncle was arrested for sexually abusing another child.
Mm.
That put me apart. Not a month or two after that, one of my family members my cousins who had also been abused by that uncle, he then, we discovered, had been abusing another family member of his. And went to jail for that. So they're both literally in jail at the same time. And this was all while I'm diving into this, you know, of my own personal kind of, and seeing within extended family and acquaintances and stuff that knew us, a lot of those same, I took quotes directly from what they were saying at that time, because that's what they said when I was little. And my mom, especially, both of my parents were very, my dad was a state trooper, you know, both of them were very protective, but my mom was very protective when she found out. And so it was personally just, it tore me apart. That was a very rough year. In hindsight, I would never have chosen that. In hindsight, I think that's what sort of kept me sane during that year, was processing it through writing. And that's is what I've always done. I've always processed everything through it. Just this morning, I started the day out writing every day. Processed a really stupid dream, you know, that I had. That was not a good dream, and I didn't know what it meant. From the little all the way to the big. So I think that helped me. The actual sort of template mechanics of writing. It's funny because I look at that now and I don't love how I wrote it. I've learned a lot in the whatever, however many years it's been since I wrote that. At the same time, if I had waited until I was a better scriptwriter to write that, it just, I don't think it would have had the impact. I don't think it would have been as honest. I think I would have been thinking of it in more how to structure this a little bit better. It was definitely pretty raw. And I think that's why it struck people both in here I could produce this and struck people as far as audience members, that it was a pretty honest look. And I usually have to be very, very tight. I do my best writing very late at night because there's a resistance for everybody to telling the truth on paper. It's a very intimidating space. And that's why a lot of people get freaked out by writing, is it's you on there. And you kind of automatically try and cover up those flaws and hide that a little bit when you're writing and it's staring it back at you. So when I write really late at night and I'm just tired is usually my most honest writing. And I'm horrified when I wake up and I'm like, I can't believe I put that down. But I usually try and go with it. And that's what that kind of whole year, I was exhausted that whole year. And I think ultimately that helped the play. So
was the writing it a cathartic experience?
It was, I think what was more cathartic, which is unique to theater. I was still pretty traumatized that year, honestly, like, and seeing it, and it was seeing how it was received, how my mom, I was really worried about how my mom would receive it because it was an awful lot about her. I would argue and say that more than myself, she was the main character in that play. And fortunately, you know, I think she saw what I was trying to do and loved it and supported it, wrote, literally made blankets for the play, Tlinkit button robes. It was actually in the reception of it because I was terrified. I was absolutely terrified because the public, for me as a child, the public just mostly being extended family, did not receive news of my actual abuse well as far as my mom and I, and that's what the play is about. So I was very, I was so terrified of what the wider public would now think. Because like, is this going to be just more rejection on a huge public scale? Like I was terrified. And every community that we went to, or every audience that came and saw it, who would go in, and I'd be worried about my story and how they'd take my story, and they'd come out and they'd start talking about their stories. And I'm going to get choked up again just talking about it, because like that was the truth. Catharsis was going like, oh, if I tell them this sort of awful, horrible experience, like it isn't just about me. By the way, this happens to way too many people. And they came out talking about that. And like, more than anything, more than the actual writing, which is helps you anyway, it helps you kind of figure stuff out, or at least it helps me figure stuff out. It was the reaction to it that got me to think about what had happened to me differently, and feeling so isolated and alone and going, wow, there's a huge community out here who are going through the same things or want to know how to get out of that, or needed someone like my mother to fight for them and didn't. And just showing them like this is, you're seen, you're heard, and vice versa. It made me feel more seen and heard too.
So I want to ask about storytelling, because storytelling is as old as time. really. And your theater productions, especially your second play at Perseverance, Devilfish, which produced in 2019, seem to be working at blending the idea of Western theater and Native storytelling. Was that the goal of that production? And how did you think about bringing those two ideas together?
That was definitely at a time where now I had sort of been in the quote-unquote American theater world for a bit and gone through my first production of the play and written some other short things. And I was feeling a little bit jaded as far as the reaction that I would get so many times from a lot of people in the theater world were, oh, the Native people are so new to this. Mm. And they're so, it's so good to see you guys finally into this thing that we hold up in such high regard. And it was such a dissociative thing for me to go into and just go like, no, we've been doing this for thousands of years. The Western world didn't allow us to do it for quite a while. You're right. Like there was a couple generations there when it was literally illegal for us to do our performing arts. But really brave people held on to them, really brave, in our case, Tlingit people and Alaska Native people held on to what they could from that. And we knew production value. Like Tlingits knew production value. Like we sure as heck, you know, knew how to put on a performance that made a splash, not to mention just really good storytelling. And I think that when I was writing that, there came a really important time when I wasn't loving my first draft. It was pretty awful. I actually sent it, so my mentor, Larissa, sent it to her and was like, this is it. I had a huge long page of email about like, this is awful and I hate it. And she sent the greatest email that I've still saved to this point, where it was basically, she said, you did it. You wrote your second play. You accomplished, you fought through it. We have it. We can look at it. Yes, it's awful. She's so brutally honest. Yes, it's awful. But we couldn't fix what we couldn't see. Now we could see it. Now we know what to fix. And you already know, you know, the problems with it. And there became a really important part about 6 months later when we were going to do the first workshop for it that I was just not excited about the workshop. I was like, okay, I know we're going to go in and we're going to hire some actors and we're going to workshop this play and it's going to take this much time. And I was like, I mean, I'm going to do it. It needs it. It needs work. And she said, well, if you could do anything, what would you do? And I was like, I would take it to the community. I would take it to the communities it's from. I would take it to the villages it's based in. I would go back to the land that this story is based on, where my ancestors are from. And she's like, well, let's do that then instead. And it was such a pivotal moment for me as a writer, as a playwright, to go, oh, I don't have to follow the rules of what you're supposed to do next. So that's what we did. We took this weeks-long journey on the ferry, and it rained the entire time for this poor California Lakota girl who came up with me. It was drenched. She was drenched. This was a very southeast summer for her. Literally the day she left, it turned into sun. But we went to Devilfish Bay, where that's where my answers are from. That's where the story's from. We went to a village that hasn't existed since the 1800s and saw some of the remnants there. We toured all through Southeast and brought the play and read the play with actual community members. And what was amazing, that not only was that story better for hearing from the actual people who told it originally, and it was exciting to actually hear people like read this play and then recognize, like, oh, we know this story. Like, this is, it actually wasn't this, it was sort of the sequel to the story that they'd heard. They immediately recognized it, and that was pretty cool. What also came from that was a second story, which was Native Pride and Prejudice. So I actually kind of got two plays out of that whole trip of just listening to the people who live on the land and who do things here every day. So it kind of started out of just a little bit of frustration with the Western way of doing things. And when I just leaned into the authenticity of where this story comes from, which is authentically from me, who comes from this land also, but also from the people who've always been telling this. And that continued through the production. We did kind of the same things through the production of going like, okay, this isn't a Tlingit story. Where in the storytelling process are we, whether it's with the dance needs to be authentically Tlingit, whether it's with the singing, whether it's with the costumes, which were all needed to look authentic for the sort of prehistoric Tlingit time, for the actual objects that they had. So that authenticity of storytelling was born in that time. I should say the drive for it and the drive to like do it no matter what sort of the Western forces might be trying to tell you to do.
We'll take a break and we'll come back and talk with more with Vera Starbart, Emmy-nominated writer and Alaska's Writer Laureate through 2026. This is Juno Afternoon's Rainy Day Conversations from KTOO. Welcome back to Juno Afternoon, a rainy day conversation with Vera Starbart, my guest, a three-time Emmy-nominated writer and the Alaska State Writer Laureate. I want to turn to business. The standard question, how did you get an agent?
I feel like I'm the most unhelpful writer sometimes because they came to me. But it wasn't. Like, I say that as if it's all accidental. It was actually during Native Pride and Prejudice showcase with the National New Play Network. And they had heard about the play. They'd heard about, you know, Our Voices Will Be Heard.
This was in New York?
This was in, yes, New York. This was during COVID. So Native Pride and Prejudice was unfortunately a COVID casualty as far as that was probably going to be my next production. And then we all know what happened, especially the
theater.
Don't
know what you're talking about.
Yeah. Yes. And because of those other things that I did in the workshops, and they'd heard it, that my agent had heard about it and had been told about it by someone I worked with in Howland, which is so much of how sort of the quote-unquote industry, I mean, several industries, really, TV, film, theater, book publishing, but any of those industries work an awful lot with someone having worked with someone who you've worked with you've worked with. And that's ultimately, well, I say it's accidental. It's just from working really hard with other people and doing something that they like. And then they tell your name to someone else and say, hey, this person is really good to work with. And that's how my getting an agent came about. And then they knew the TV film agent that I now work with, or she's now my manager. So I have, you know, multiple agents, which sounds really weird, but for each of those genres, like I, a little bit of a strange writer in that I work with a lot of different mediums, different writing mediums, and you kind of do need different representatives for each of those different ones. So I'm even talking to a book agent now because, you know, we're getting to that point, but.
Well, that was going to be one of my questions was, is there a novel in your future?
Yes. And while I frustratingly cannot tell anything about it, I can say officially, because I asked, that I do have a book contract with Scholastic. It's for a middle grade book. And that's really all I can say about it, other than it's going to be probably about a year and a half before anyone's actually going to see it, because book publishing takes so long. But yes, I am in the middle right now of writing my first traditionally published book. I've done some kind of fun things with other things, but
and you've had essays and other collections and things like that. There was one that came out, was it last year?
The MTV Books Illuminatives, Growing Up Native in America. Life Growing Up Native in America, there's an essay that I had in that.
Yeah, that's cool. Okay, so we understand how you got an agent. Can you share with us how Molly of Denali came about?
That definitely came about in kind of a similar way as far as people that I'd been working with. I actually had three or four different people recommending me when WGBH at the time, they're GBH now, producers, creators of Molly were going through Alaska and they were working with different Gwich'in people, mostly in Fairbanks, but also kind of going around the state and asking who else should we be working with? And three or four different people gave them my name as someone who both had written scripts, who loved storytelling, someone who might have something to say about that. And so I met with them. The funny part was actually when I first met with them, there was a misunderstanding of why I thought they were just talking to me for a writer for the show. And I thought that was pretty cool. But it's like, this is like, we're going in an hour two of this interview for a writer. And that's very unusual. You don't really, you know, you haven't asked to see my work yet. They were actually interviewing me for a producer job. Mm. And we're all happy that they went with someone else for that, because I didn't actually understand what they were. But I actually, before, when they called me with that, I was like, that's great. That's great. But I would love to talk to you again when you're hiring writers. And they kind of laughed. And they're like, we're absolutely going to talk to you when we're hiring writers. And about a year later, the show got a green light. And they were, I got the call. And that was pretty exciting. And that really, if I hadn't done playwriting, I wouldn't have been talked to about that, because they were looking for, well, originally they were looking for Alaska Native TV writers, which isn't much of a thing, or it wasn't at the time.
It wasn't at the time, but now it's a little bit better.
Now we have quite a few, mm-hmm. I mean, nominated Alaska Native TV writers.
I'm assuming that also led to Alaska Daily at that point, which people may remember that series from 2024 starring Hilary Swank, and you wrote the finale.
Yes. Yeah, which ended up, it was going to be the finale for the season and ended up being the finale for the show, which was no small amount of pressure. Yeah, that was absolutely what led to it, just as far as they were, again, looking for experienced Alaska Native TV writers. And there aren't that many of us, but there were more of us because of Molly O'Donnelly and the opportunities that we got on the show.
And there was another Alaskan writer in the writer's room with you on Alaska Daily.
Yes, Andrew McLean. He is Inupiaq, originally from Ukiavik, who was living in New York at the time where the show got written. And he had worked on the initial pilot with the creator, Tom McCarthy. He is great. And I think he liked having another Alaska Native person in the room, because he's used to being in New York and not many Alaska Native people. They're certainly not Alaska Native TV writers, or TV professionals. So, yeah, that was a pretty incredible experience, kind of surreal, because I got, from the time I talked to them, while I was aware of the script and I knew some people working on it, from the time I actually got interviewed for the job, because, and this is TV, like, it's hurry up and wait. Like, you wait and wait and wait. And they were waiting on this pilot green light for well over a year. They got the green light, and within 72 hours, I was in New York to write for the show. And that's sort of what I now know is pretty classic.
So there seems to be more Native representation in the mainstream media. And we're talking about film and television and maybe some other areas too. And so you've played a part in that now. What have you learned in these years that you've been on that side of it now about Native representation in mainstream media?
I definitely have learned a lot about what it appears to be versus what it actually is. I'm really excited to see much more authentic Native stories being told, and authentic meaning we are the ones telling it. We are the ones originating it. And for almost the entire sort of history of TV and film, our stories have been told by anyone but us, up to and including non-Natives portraying Natives, but certainly not Native people actually writing the stories that are seen. And the biggest points of culture about Native people were not influenced by Native people. That, I think, in the 70s or so, started in sort of this first Native Renaissance, when a lot of those things that were literally illegal for us to do, that was lifted. And so you sort of saw that first Renaissance in people being aware that there's an authenticity that they're missing. Not that much was done about that in TV or film. I think different stories were being told, but it was still being told by other people. And there was sort of this pity or, you know, victimization kind of look at that time, or this sort of unrealistic look at it, like this, the noble Indian, noble savage kind of idea. The 90s, I think, saw an interesting part where they're more aware that these are not very authentic, and there was more consulting. And I think that's where the big, there'd been some vague consulting the whole time, but in like the 90s, there was much more of a effort to get real Native people involved. But all of this time, there was no power for Native people. You might have a Native consultant, but you don't have to listen to them. And that was sort of used as an excuse a lot. It's like, well, we had a Native consultant. Did you listen to them? Did they actually make any changes? A lot of times those Native consultants were just asked to, like, tell us these Lakota words or these Navajo words and be on your way. I think now what we're seeing is a bit of a waking up to, and literally just the last few years, like this isn't an extended thing, but there's finally a waking up to, we have to be in the rooms writing it. We have to be producing it. We have to be directing it. You're not going to get authentic Native stories if we're not decision makers in that process. And while it feels like to people who have never seen true authenticity on the screen before of ourselves, certainly not as an Alaska Native or Tlingit, we're now at a point where, while because it feels like so much more, because it's 1,000% more than we've ever had, but we didn't have anything before. While it feels like that, being in some of those rooms or more often than not being in some of those rooms where those decisions are being made about us, without us, it's an interesting time. It's definitely a transition time. I think there's an awareness there by some people in power, not enough awareness by enough people in power. But the people doing that work, Sterling Harjo, you know, is one of the big names right now. Whew, like they're really doing it, and they're making differences like one room at a time. So my role, as I see it, is to work in that capacity building. We need in the industry more people with experience. And that's sort of the running joke of the experience. It's who you know. Well, if you don't know any Native people, those Native people are never going to get that experience. Like it's sort of a circular thing. So my job is to provide as many other jobs, big or small, in the capacity I can do, while at the same time trying to excel in writing in what I do and go, look, here's at least one Native writer who you know, who you've seen can do this job well. Maybe I'll give a chance to another one. And at the same time, write in roles. And I have written in roles where they've asked before, like, oh, would a Native person have that job? And the answer is always yes. Yes, that has to be a Native actor. Because, of course, the only person who could do that job is a Native person. You give more Native people the experience so they'll get hired for the next job. And it's a frustrating industry and it drives you a little crazy, but it's also really exciting. And it reaches more people than most other things we know, more than a book even, which is weird to say as like a book nerd. More people will see that TV show and see that representation. And when I get most discouraged about it, I still have to go, yeah, but that's a lot more representation than we had a week ago.
Vera Starbart, it has been a pleasure to have you on our rainy day conversation here on Juno Afternoon. Thank you so much for spending your afternoon with us. Gunath Tish, for being here.
Gunath Tish.
And that will do it for today's Rainy Day Conversation with Vera Starbard. Find Vera online. She's extremely active on social media, and you can see more about her work at verastarbard.com. That's VeraStarbard.com. Juno Afternoon airs Wednesday through Friday at 3 p.m. right here on KTOO Juno 104.3 and KAUK Juno Akbe 91.7. Find the show online at ktoo.org/JunoAfternoon. Our theme music is by Indian Agent. Support for this program comes from Heritage Coffee and Hanson Grass. Rainy Day Conversations is a project of Juno Afternoon and the KTOO Arts and Culture team. I'm Boston Christopher, producer and host. Gunath Jeej for listening today, wherever you are around the globe.